Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today, we welcome back Jacob Shapiro. Jacob is a geopolitical expert and someone we rely on heavily for his input on what's going on around the world. Jacob, nice to see you.
Nice to be back with you, Nick. I can't imagine what we're possibly going to talk about today.
So, Jacob, let's start with Donald Trump. The odds makers have him returning to the White House here in January 2025. I think that over the last few weeks, while things were looking pretty close, there's been some separation here in the last 3 to 4 to 5 days. What are your thoughts here on Trump's likelihood? And then why don't you get right into what do you think it might mean for geopolitics for the United States?
Yeah, I mean, these are impossible questions, Nick, but I will do my best. I will also tell your listeners, I didn't think Trump had a prayer in 2016, so I don't exactly have a track record here that inspires a ton of trust. I will tell you that all of the polling that I can see tells me it's a toss-up, that it's really difficult to get a sense of which direction it's going. Polling is also backward-looking data, so it's really not telling us anything about how things might change in the future, whether that's the U.S. government response to Hurricane Milton, which we still have to see, whether it's the ongoing war in the Middle East and how U.S. actions could change that, maybe relationship with China. Like, lots can happen down to the wire. But I would say, if you put a gun to my head and said, Jacob, you have to make a call one way or the other, it seems to me that Trump is the slight favorite. I think that Harris got a big narrative boost, with Biden stepping down, coming out of the convention. You can tell the media wants it for her. But when you actually look at the polls, everything's within the margin of error in all the swing states. And ultimately, this is going to come down to a very, very simple equation. Can Kamala Harris convince people in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Georgia, Arizona, can she convince enough of them that she is better than Trump? And while she gets a lot of support on a lot of different issues, the one thing that voters still seem to trust Trump more with, which it's a mystery to me why they trust him more with this, but they do, so it doesn't matter whether I understand it or not, is they think he's better for the economy. And as long as Trump is the economy guy, I mean, it goes back to what James Carville said all the way back in the early 1990s, it's about the economy, stupid, so it's hard to bet against that. In terms of what a Trump presidency looks like, look, the first go-round was not as destructive, I think, as destructive as many analysts thought that it might be. At the same time, though, it was incredibly volatile, and he was unpredictable. And he made a lot of decisions in his own mind that then would be reflected out and would catch people off guard. A really good example of what I'm talking about, even after he'd lost the election, and in the weeks before Biden took over, it seemed like he woke up one morning and decided, oh, maybe we're going to make Vietnam a currency manipulator. Even though the last 4 years of strategy had been get manufacturing out of China, which means, of course, Vietnam is going to soak up some of that interest. And so you had companies scrambling because all of a sudden the Trump administration was calling out this potential for Vietnam as a currency manipulator. So my instinct is to say it'll be somewhat the same. The sky won't be falling, but there's going to be a measure of unpredictability in what Trump is going to do. And the last thing is, he has said on the campaign trail over and over again, 60% tariffs against China and 10% tariffs for every other country in the world across the board. That's not technically legal. I'm fascinated to know how he's going to think about going and enforcing that. But he's found ways to do things before that people thought were technically illegal. And if that's the case, I mean, is that a massive jump in inflation? Is that actually a deflationary problem because people are going to look at the sticker price and get depressed and we're going to get demand destruction? I don't know. But if he follows through on some of those things, it's a lot of uncertainty for the economy, and it's especially uncertain for U.S. allies. Like, we know that the U.S. and China are going to be at odds, but he's talked a very tough road against countries like Mexico, like the European Union, like South Korea, all relationships that the Biden administration has prioritized on repairing since Trump left the first time. So that's a long-winded answer, but that's the best I can do for now.
The Bitcoin Layer is sponsored by Unchained, the undisputed leader in Bitcoin financial services. Unchained empowers you to take full control of your Bitcoin with collaborative multi-sig vaults in which you own 2 of 3 keys and you gain a Bitcoin security partner. You can purchase Bitcoin directly into your cold storage via Unchained's trading desk and eliminate all exchange risks. Unchained also offers the best IRA in the industry, where you can convert your existing 401ks or retirement accounts to Unchained all while keeping control of your Bitcoin private keys. Don't pay more in taxes than you have to. Talk to Unchained today. Go to unchained.com/TBL for $100 off when you sign up.
Sure. And what we see here in the markets, Jacob, is a trade up in yields over the last few days. And I do believe that a trade up in yields and a trade up in stocks is a pro-growth trade. It's a, hey, I don't need as much risk-off protection here. I can let go of some of my treasuries, and I can go long stocks here at the margin because of a Trump presidency. So I'm seeing that at the margin. I know it's tough to look too closely at these things, but we do. My question to you is, on markets, do you put, it sounds like you don't put much faith in Polymarket or these prediction markets, but I'm curious, if you do, why or why not? Because I look at an aggregate of them, but I think that Polymarket now, especially on a state-by-state level, is giving us a ton of signal. And if you do the math on Arizona, Georgia, North Carolina being locks, then all Trump would need is Pennsylvania. He doesn't even need Wisconsin or Michigan or Nevada. And so when I look at the map and I do the numbers and I see Pennsylvania trading at 56, 57% this morning, it almost seems like there's no path. So I'm curious your thoughts on the prediction markets.
I take them as a data point, but I don't take anything as gospel in that sense. And I also think one of the reasons it's so hard to get data on this is ultimately emotional, and people are going to be protective of showing their opinions, whether it's to a pollster or to markets. It's very hard to get data on that very, very small number of swing voters, some of whom might be making their decision literally as they walk into the ballot box, or even making their decision by deciding whether they're going to go and vote that day. The difference in this election might not have anything to do with individual voter preference. It just might be who is motivated enough to get off their butts and actually get to a polling station. I think that's maybe Harris's best argument, that the general passion around Trump has declined a little bit. You have more Republicans who are just like, yes, we would support Trump over Harris, but we're not as excited as we were before. We've got January 6th and all the things that he says and the lawsuits and the intelligence that was found at Mar-a-Lago. Like, you start stacking it on top of each other, maybe you have less enthusiasm. But that's why I said, if you're a betting man, if you're playing the markets, yeah, I mean, Trump looks like the favorite to me, because even in the polls, it doesn't look like Harris has got the numbers in Arizona. To my own shock, as somebody from Georgia, and based on how Trump has treated Georgia officials, Georgia doesn't seem to be going in for Harris at all. Wisconsin has been pretty solidly Democrat, even when Biden was there. So I think maybe Wisconsin is the only safe one that Harris can really put in her quiver. And I think you're also right to say that, like, Pennsylvania is the big one. And it's hard for me to believe that Harris is going to be able to convince enough Pennsylvanians to get it to flip to her. So I take your point on the market data. I try to follow it myself, but there are limits to how much these types of statistics can give us insight into what is ultimately an emotional decision for most voters.
Sure, of course. And yes, with Pennsylvania, he's at 281. So he doesn't even need Nevada. The margin is there. Let's move to the Red Sea, because it's not a story I've tracked as closely as you have, of course. What is happening in the Red Sea? What are the implications for global trade right now, looking forward? What's the timeline? And you can tie in the broader Israel-Hezbollah conflict as well.
There's so much energy around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and around Iran that I think we're really missing the big story here. And the big story hasn't changed that much. Since roughly December of 2023, so December of last year, there has been no legitimate shipping through the Red Sea and through the Suez Canal, period. And that is absolutely remarkable. The much vaunted U.S. Navy, with all of its aircraft carriers and all of its billions of dollars and all of its fancy technologies, it has not been able to shut down the threat to Red Sea shipping from a ragtag group of Yemeni militants called the Houthis. And I think when historians look back, 10, 15 years from now, when they're looking back at 2024, I don't think the first story is going to be the U.S. election or the Indian election or the Mexican election or Hurricane Milton. I think it's going to be the inability of the United States to bring shipping back to where it was pre the October 7th attacks. Now, the second thing to say here, and the thing that has surprised even me, is that in the last 2 to 3 months, it almost seems like Israel is trying to avenge its massive intelligence and security failure on October 7th of last year by showing just how much they can do. So even a couple months ago, we were talking about, oh, Iran has all these proxies and Israel is losing hearts and minds on the world stage because of how they're treating the Palestinians, and Hezbollah is a big threat, and maybe it can use anti-ship missiles to attack even Israel's natural gas platforms, blah, blah. Israel's decimated Hamas in the Gaza Strip. It has decapitated the leadership of Hezbollah with new and disturbing attacks using these pagers and walkie-talkies. It hit the Houthis a couple of weeks ago, something I didn't even think they had the capability to do because of the range. And now you've got the Prime Minister of Israel literally threatening the Iranian leader, the people of Lebanon, asking the people of Iran and Lebanon to rise up and throw down their leaders. So I've sort of gone back to square one with my analysis, because Israel is showing much more strength than it did even a couple of months ago. And wouldn't it be ironic if Israel was able to be the country that actually reopened the Red Sea by striking at the Houthis? If they could do to the Houthis what they did to Hezbollah, they'd probably get a thank you note from the White House, because that would take off a big problem from what the White House is looking at. The last thing I'll just say here, because, you know, I think a lot of the attention is not on what matters. The other country that is just sitting there silently that nobody is talking about is Turkey. And they are the big power in the region going forward in the next 10 to 15 years. You had a little bit of noise from Erdogan talking a couple months ago about, oh, we have to build up our military so that we could protect the Palestinians in the future from future Israeli onslaughts. I stopped in my tracks when I saw that. That's a Turkish threat for military intervention in Israel right there, coy and sort of, you know, in a party headquarters sort of situation. But still, that's what the threat is. And Turkey's been very quiet. They've already got troops in northern Syria, northern Iraq. They are not getting hit by the United States sanctions or by Israeli missiles. I think they're quietly biding their time. And I think, you know, when we're thinking about the future of this region, it's going to come down in large measure to the decisions that happen in Ankara and in Istanbul, not in any of the cities that we're talking about today.
Very interesting. Talk to us more about the Red Sea implications on global trade. What are the oil implications, energy implications? What are, give us more of the circumstances around this Red Sea shutdown. What could Trump do about it? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, if we go back in history, when Red Sea shipping was threatened in the late 1980s, the United States bombed Iran directly and reopened the shipping lanes. So maybe you could see a possibility for either a Harris or a Trump administration. Harris has been very hawkish on the campaign trail about Iran and about the Middle East in general. Maybe the United States decides to go after the Houthis themselves. I'm actually a little mystified that the Biden administration hasn't done it themselves. As it pertains to oil, look, the oil market is oversupplied. And that has been the big reprieve in Red Sea shipping. We haven't really noticed that Red Sea shipping has ground to a halt because oil has been so cheap. And so there was a brief uptick in prices, but then all the shipping companies, okay, now we go around Africa. So it's going to take a little bit more time, but once you get ships in rotation, once you get the sequencing down, you're not going to feel things that much. And when oil is 60 a barrel, 70 a barrel, okay, so we're really just talking about time. We're not talking about increased costs. Now, if you had something that created a sharp spike in the price of oil, suddenly that extra time, those extra days at sea, well, that could start to cumulatively drive up prices a little bit. I just don't think we're there. And I don't think that you're going to see Israel strike Iranian oil infrastructure. I don't think the United States is going to like that. And there hasn't been any signal that Iran or any of these Gulf countries are interested in that sort of thing. If anything, they're talking about trying to raise the price of oil by, getting rid of production cuts. Like, I don't think there's any incentive for anyone to do that sort of thing. So the oil market is oversupplied, and this conflict has really not affected oil in the way that I think most people expected. And that's because literally no one, the Israelis included, have an incentive to drive up the price of oil. And the Iranians, I will also say, this is another sign of their weakness. They're the last ones who want to do this, and that's their one key Trump card. That, you know, they could mess around with the Straits of Hormuz, or maybe they could cut back oil production. Okay, but then they go broke. And then all those, you know, Israeli threats about maybe the Iranian people will overthrow the regime, then they become operative. So it doesn't seem to me that this is going to affect oil prices in any meaningful way, if it hasn't already.
You mentioned the walkie-talkies and the beepers. talk to us about that. What are some of your larger takeaways, and how can we, maybe if you can name any Western-based companies that you feel this impacts either directly, indirectly, geopolitically?
So often I think my job as an analyst is to say, this is not important, or the media is making too big a deal of this, or stop with the melodrama. On this, on the pager's walkie-talkie thing, I'm the opposite. I feel like it's an absolutely massive deal, and I've been banging on the table about it, and I'm sort of mystified that people don't think it's a bigger deal. What the Israelis did was they basically hacked a supply chain, or created, you know, shell companies that could do basically the same thing. And they put explosives in an electronic device and sent it. You know, they didn't just sell them to Hezbollah. They sent them all over the place. So they had to make sure that the explosives were only in the Hezbollah ones, not in the ones that they sent to other places. By the way, I'm dying to know what the Hezbollah Ministry of Beeper acquisition looks like. I want to talk to the guy who's in charge of acquiring the beepers. That seems like an interesting organizational quirk to Hezbollah. But anyway, I don't really see the difference between that and, say, could a non-state actor or even a state actor intercept a shipment of wheat or food and lace it with poison? What's the difference between this thing with beepers and, say, genetically modifying a virus to attack an individual or a family, or if you want to get really grim, an ethnic group? When you start fooling with these sorts of things, like, it feels like Pandora's box is open. One of the reasons that we haven't had more cyber attacks from state actors is because a lot of state actors know, sort of like with nuclear weapons, once you pass a certain line, there's a level of mutually assured destruction. And I think one of the things that Israel did here was it kind of opened that can of worms. Because yes, Israel had this great success, but at what cost? Is Israel going to be able to ensure that its supply chain for all of the electronics that it uses is completely protected from actors who want to attack Israel? If you're a high profile CEO or executive, are you going to trust where your devices are coming from? Are you going to be worried that somebody could get into your devices and not just spy on you, but use it against you? Suddenly, the Trump administration's crusade against Huawei, which I was very critical of because it was worried about Chinese telecom kit gear in 5G networks, suddenly that seems much more realistic and much more pressing. I really think in a way it helps us see how, you know, even 10, 15 years ago, everybody was worshiping at the altar of free trade and globalization. And now we can't even trust that our supply chains are secure enough that the devices that we buy from seemingly legitimate companies aren't going to blow up in our face because of geopolitical differences between countries. I just, maybe I'm overstating it, and I've had tons of analyst friends who tell me, hey, Jacob, like, you've really gone off your rocker here with this one. But it just sets a really dangerous precedent to me and tells me something disturbing about the future of globalization and global trade.
The executive on CNBC from Palantir Technologies basically admitting that if we were involved, we wouldn't be able to say it anyway was a moment for me. Like, I also think it's a big deal, Jacob. I don't know what is going to come of it, but this idea that protection of supply chains because of war concerns, forget profit for a second entirely, it brings this whole different realm of possibilities into corporate dealings. Jacob, I want to shift gears to China. We had a very large attempted stimulus out of China and a rally in Chinese stocks, a rally in the Chinese currency that has since reversed dramatically. I know you're covering a lot of China, by the way. Go read Jacob, you could maybe plug this after I ask you. Read Jacob's weekly, because it's an excellent weekend read, quick hits from around the world. So what's going on in China with the stimulus, Xi Jinping, the politics there?
Yeah, so I mean, in some ways, if you're thinking about just the global economy, this is probably the biggest story in the world. I color myself skeptical right now, because yes, they in terms of policy announcements or posture, it was a sea change. But in terms of actual practical things that they're doing, it's relatively underwhelming, especially the size of what we're talking about. But you did see the Chinese government basically come out and say, okay, we are going to stimulate the economy, and we're going to try and do things like direct payouts around a holiday in October to people who are poor, or we're going to set up a kind of lending facility so that people can borrow to buy stocks, which is a big deal. Like most Chinese people aren't buying stocks, they're buying real estate. You had a massive injection, or at least reports of, I don't think they've actually confirmed this, but reports of a massive injection of capital into the big state banks. The last time that happened was 2008. So if you look around at it, it definitely seems like there is a policy shift and that China's thinking more about stimulus and more about growth. All that said, so far what we've seen, it's too small. It's not going to amount to anything in the grand scheme of China's problems. It does nothing to affect the underlying fundamental structural problems within the Chinese economy. One little handout around a holiday to poor people is not enough to get people to go out and start buying things or buying EVs or buying stocks. You're just not there yet. And you haven't really impacted that cultural change where Chinese people are going to, instead of saving money under the mattress or buying more real estate, that they're going to go out and take risk or be entrepreneurs or buy equities. That's just not the culture of China. And with good reason. If you put yourself in the shoes of a Chinese citizen, like recent history doesn't make you think that that is something that maybe you particularly want to do. So it's strange. I find myself in the weird position of saying I'm a long-term China bull. Like I think China will slowly metabolize its way through these problems over the next 5 to 10 years. I think Xi Jinping basically named himself emperor, de facto emperor, because he's going to have to massively redistribute wealth from the coast to the interior without setting off a revolution or without the knives coming out from other factions. I think that's the long game that he's playing. But in the short run, I'm not convinced that things have changed quite that much. There's an exuberance in Western markets and foreign markets about what China is doing, but I don't see that same exuberance inside of China, and I'm not convinced that foreign investor behavior is necessarily going to change things meaningfully. We also have the uncertainty around the election coming. Like, what if Trump gets in? What if it is 60% tariffs? What does that do to the Chinese economy? I don't really know is the answer to that question. The last thing I'll just tell you is on the wealth management side of our business, that doesn't mean we aren't interested in China. There are certain sectors like solar or batteries or even semiconductors where there are some very, very beat down, really, really interesting opportunities that if you have high risk tolerance, it might be a very good idea to go after them. But the notion that China is just going to go up and to the right, and if you just allocate to a Chinese ETF, like great, like it's off to the races. I'm a little skeptical about that, even if there is a lot of sudden groundswell around optimism.
Any thoughts on the Chinese currency versus the dollar implications from the stimulus or Trump presidency, tariffs, all of that?
That's a much more difficult question to answer. And the honest answer to your question is no, I don't really have a good sense of where that's at. In times of, you know, international instability, the dollar is still the global safe asset that most people are going to flock to. So we've seen a little bit of weakness in the dollar here lately, but I don't really expect that to continue, because if the world is going to get more volatile, and I mean, we've got war in the Middle East, we've got war in Europe, we've got all sorts of conflicts that are happening all over the place. I just don't see that the dollar is going to be any less in demand. So maybe you'll get some changing around the edges there, but it's hard for me to think that the PBOC or that these relations are going to change anything meaningfully when it comes to the yuan. But there's a lot of uncertainty there. I'll be the first one to admit it.
Yeah, we're watching it closely. The dollar has rallied here over the last week or so fairly aggressively on, we believe, just a straight higher yields trade and that risk interest rate parity. And as the dollar strengthens on higher yields, it puts the rest of the world more in a more precarious position economically. So the strengthening dollar is a tighter financial condition on the world. We are wondering how tight it could get for China, triggering maybe a potential devaluation and the implications of that, the knock-on implications of that on the rest of global markets.
Yeah, I hear you. The only thing that I would add to that I feel like is some insight to add is that, you know, when I look at the Fed, I don't really know what the Fed is doing. It feels to me like they're cutting into strength. And maybe they have a crystal ball that allows them to see better than I can. But it seems like the Fed and the White House are just, they're living in diametrically opposed world where industrial policy and monetary policy just really aren't lining up. And it's not clear to me that inflation has really been defeated. Like, okay, there's low oil prices, but if some of these shipping problems that we're talking about come to pass, if some of these US-China trade relation problems that we're talking about come to pass, really easy for me to see that inflation might surprise to the upside. And then what is the Fed going to do? Are they going to keep cutting? Are they going to start raising and say that they made a mistake? Like, It's, I don't know. I wouldn't want that job. Good luck to them. I'm not trying to rain on their parade, but I'm a little nervous about the path that they've chosen.
Well, I'll give you my closing thoughts here. They definitely haven't defeated inflation, but I believe that with inflation anywhere between 2 and 4, it's low enough for them to just try to uninvert the curve for the financial system, because a repo charge that's higher than your average 10-year treasury is just punitive for banks every single night. And I just believe that uninverting the curve from a financial plumbing perspective is important enough, and they have cover with enough disinflation in the system. But you are right to watch the potential reignition of that inflation and the potential, you know, impacts, and what the Fed will have to do to make up for the fact that it's already been cutting rates. Jacob Shapiro, thank you as always for joining us and sharing with us your expertise on geopolitics. Please tell people where they can find your work and how they can read your weekly letter.
Yeah, gosh, there's so much of it right now. So you can find me either at the Bespoke Group. You can find me at Cognitive Investments. There is the Jacob Shapiro podcast. You can also either sign up for the weekly letter that you talked about, either via Cognitive Investments, or I've actually started putting it out on Substack with graphics. So you can find me also, Jacob Shapiro, on Substack too. So there are no shortage of places to find my work. And these days, my fingers are getting sore with how much I'm having to type every single week. I'm waiting for it to slow down, and it just keeps speeding up.
Jacob Shapiro, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll catch you guys next time.
Cheers.